show. Head on with Bob Kincaid. 3 hours of conversation, cussing, and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head on with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bicod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy! Experiment here. This is The Horn. HeadOnRadioNetwork.com is our home. This is Titanic Tuesday, the 18th day of March 2014. I'm Bob Kincaid. We like to call what we do here conversation radio. We're going to find out exactly, well, I don't know. There may be some sort of spring is springing miracle in place, and I've been trying repeatedly all day long to see if anything would happen. I'm waiting, and for the first time ever, or well, for the first time in over 24 hours, the telephone system seems to be booting. It remains to be seen whether anything will come of it, or if it's just going to, well, I don't know. I was hoping. Anyway, welcome to Titanic Tuesday. What kind of noises is the phone system making? Hey, it's the same noises as last night. Thank you, Appalachian Power. I talked briefly with the folks at the company. You know, this stuff is made with great talent and care here in the United States of America. And, well, I was talking with them earlier today about how to go through diagnostics and so forth. Sorry, I'm not trying to burden you with our troubles here, but to the extent that this is a telephone call-in program, having a telephone becomes somehow or another a rather interesting, and critical element in the ongoing process. So I think it's safe to say, no, there's not going to be any early spring miracle. Stand by for a sec. Okay, well, you know, hope springs eternal. By the way, if you want to join, absent the telephones, a great way to participate in the conversation is to go on over to the HeadOnRadioNetwork.com chat room. It's easy to find. Just go to HeadOnRadioNetwork.com and click chat room. See how easy? You'll also find there the spiffy new media player installed by John Fox. And as well, I've been remiss in the last couple of days of posting stories over there. I apologize, but I hope you'll understand that I've been rather eaten up with this idea of having a big chunk of our technology sort of blasted away by the coal-fired grid. So that's taken up a lot of my energy and attention. But also at HeadOnRadioNetwork.com, you will find the PayPal button. And I cannot emphasize enough how desperate it is that we meet each evening's fundraising goal if there is to continue to be a horn here in our 10th year. We try to raise $150 per evening. If we can do that this evening, that's a very, very good thing. I just hope that I hope we can. If we could raise 200 or 250 or 300, it would be that much better. Simply because, well, bills. It is Titanic Tuesday, and what with it being Titanic Tuesday, I figured we could have a little bit of fun here and there. And serious conversation, too. I started early this morning to see, I mean, when the New York Times is writing about it, and then it shows up at Talking Points Memo and a couple of other places, CNN is out there doing its shark jumping best again, this time over the Malaysia, Air Malaysia flight, Malaysia Airlines, Flight 370. And the shark jumping apparently happened on Don Lemon's program today. No, really. I mean, there has been some useful information about the missing flight out there, like the pilot who writes about questions we were asking last week regarding transponders and why they have to be turned on and off. And his answer was, well, really, they don't have to be anymore because technology exists to automate these things. But oh well. And points out that there is a vested interest in the aircraft manufacturers to be able to blame pilot error instead of something going wrong on the aircraft itself. But anyway, so there's been some useful information. But CNN ran over into the land of the useless today. Oh, dear God. I mean, really, really useless. This is just, it happened, well, part of it happened yesterday, part of it happened today. And everyone's, one of the things that the New York Times wrote about is that CNN, whose ratings have been absolutely swirling down the toilet of late, well, their ratings are rising on the Malaysian Airlines story. And there was a bit of what in the New York Times piece today, but I looked at it and thought, yeah, and? Because this is CNN's bread and butter. And I always, it you know, gives me a chance to wander back into the halcyon days of my early adulthood. Because I was there when baby Jessica McClure fell down the old well in Midland, Texas, and was trapped there for days on end. And it was the first instance in the young CNN's life when CNN marshaled its resources to do round-the-clock, nothing but coverage of a single story. And it was a really big deal because it had never happened up until that time. And so then with Bush War I, they pressed the envelope, and once again, you couldn't tear yourself away from CNN. So yesterday, the 17th, oh, dear God. Don Lemon. Well, let's just go to the, it's actually from the 16th. Let's go to the audio.
What happens to these people that it's not just that they've vanished, but we haven't heard anything in all this time. And because we all know how impossible it is, and it's where every conspiracy falls apart. How do you keep everyone quiet?
Brad, I'm glad you brought that up, because we have been talking about this. I've been getting questions from viewers on social media, through email, and even on the streets, especially today, on a day when we deal with the supernatural. When we go to church, the supernatural power of God, you deal with all of that. People are saying to me, why aren't you talking about the possibility? And I'm just putting it out there that something odd happened to this plane, something beyond our understanding. Have you dealt with that on your show, and are you surprised that people are raising those questions?
Listen, when you do a show like Decoded, no one gets crazier email than me. And we all, you know, we all kind of roll our eyes at conspiracy theories. But what conspiracy theories do is they ask the hardest, most outrageous questions sometimes. But every once in a while, they're right. And that's what we have to remember here. I mean, right? I think why it's captured our attention is because there is no logical explanation right now. Right? You can say, oh, it crashed into the ocean. But something just seems, where are the parts? Where are the pieces? Why did it keep going for 7 hours? Why do you have a guy on board who gives his watch and his ring to his wife and says, keep this for my boys in case something happens to me? And that's not some stranger. He's a mechanical engineer. Something smells wrong. And, you know, one of my favorite reporters once said to me that the American people always will sniff for the truth until they find it. And there's something about the story that just strikes us at our core where something seems really fishy. It just smells terrible. And you know what? When that happens, I'm not one of those believers in, you know, that aliens came down or anything like that. But you do have to stop and go, how does a jetliner with almost 200 people on it disappear?
Absolutely.
How are they
Absolutely.
Just gone?
Absolutely. Absolutely. The only thing is here, and let's remember, because we are operating in the natural physical world that is actually ruled by natural physical laws. Things don't just disappear. The plane, or parts of it, pieces of it, what have you, is somewhere that we have not found it yet. Is not proof that somehow or another the laws of physics and the laws of the universe quit. And this makes me crazy. And Don Lemon should be ashamed of himself for even giving a second to speculation over something supernatural happening. I mean, Jesus Christ, really? Really? The Enterprise came back and beamed up the jetliner just like they did the whale? I'll tell you a little secret. You know how there was mention in that clip of how the man gave his watch and his rings to his wife and said, hold these for my boys in case I don't come back? Every time I leave here to get on a plane, I kiss my wife and my children, and I tell them, if I don't come back, please remember that I loved you with every ounce of my being. If you forget everything else, remember that. Because stuff does still happen when you travel. Whether you're going by car, by plane, by train, by bus, or by air. It is not proof because a loving parent says, remember always that I loved you and keep these things because I'm not going to need them. I'm not going to. You're flying from Kuala Lumpur to Beijing. Really? You need your nice watch and your wedding ring? And yet there are people out there who will say, oh, well, you know, something smells fishy about that. Jesus. But we have to acknowledge that a certain portion of the people of the United States, and I guess the world, but it seems like the disease is centered here, by the way, Asa pointing out, Bob, I can't wait to hear Alex Jones and George Norrie's explanation of what happened to the plane. No, seriously, I can't wait. Yeah, that's why part of my job is running screaming into the night. Because I do. But there is centered in this country. And like I said, other parts of the world as well. You know, there are less advanced nations, for instance, where elderly people are burned alive as witches. And you know, it happens in 2013, 2014. And we tend to look at that as an example of a culture that has not quite caught on to science. I mean, we had a vice presidential candidate who had a fundamentalist evangelical come from some nation in Africa and lay hands upon her in her church and set up a wall of demon-proof godliness around her. That woman could have been a heartbeat away from the presidency. That was 2008, not 1898. Not 1808. The disease does seem to be centered in the United States. And as a rational person, it terrifies me. Because can you imagine for a moment what it would be like if we really did live in the world that these weirdos think does exist? I mean, you couldn't count on anything to actually work in predictable fashion. You could walk out into the morning sunshine someday and be struck dead by a rampaging herd of demons or be laser beamed out of the sky by an angry god? You think I'm kidding. See, the thing is, there are people who live in that world. I can't save this till tomorrow. Witness, for instance, Marion Robertson.
Hey, this is Barb, who says, my father abused my mom for years. One day he came to my home and called me horrid names. Years went by. I felt so bad on the advice of my pastor, I went to him and apologized for anything I'd ever done wrong. I was tossed out, literally, so I disowned him. I have since had cancer twice and have not been contacted by him. How do I deal with the heartache?
Well, what you'd better deal with is the fact that because of that heartache and because of the hurtfulness, that could be a cause of that cancer. You might have a feeling of loss and emptiness, and you've sort of turned off the tremendous system that you have to prevent that. There's an immune system that you need that'll function when you're forgiving. So all I can say is your father sounds like an absolute rat, and God one day is going to deal with him, and he's going to be punished horribly. But in the meantime, all you have to do is forgive him, but I would just let this thing go out of your mind, because you've tried, you've done everything you need to do. You don't have to keep reaching out. Just say, God, I forgive him. I ask you to forgive him, and I pray your blessing on him, and then get on with life.
Damn! Pat Robertson just said that not being sufficiently forgiving of an abuser causes cancer. On the other hand, my inclination is to say, gee, where does this lady live? What kind of capitalist-driven toxins have been dumped on her throughout her life? What has she breathed? What has she drunk? What has she soaked in through her skin? Because money. No. Oh, and by the way, did you notice that when he's talking, when he's praying, what she should be praying? You know, I've forgiven him. You've forgiven him. But why would you ask him to forgive him when, in fact, Pat Marion, the former liquor supply officer, has already declared that God is going to punish him horribly sometime later? From time to time, I take a little bit of grief from people saying, well, you know, Bob, I mean, it's their religion. It's okay. And it is. It is absolutely okay for them to think like this as long as they do not hurt the rest of us. But this hurts the rest of us. Oh, no. You don't have cancer because you breathed ultra fine particles underneath a mountaintop removal site for 15 years. Hell no! You just haven't forgiven them enough for blasting your life into smithereens. And that's why God sent the cancer to you. This stuff is very dangerous because it has an overarching ability to harm the rest of society. I've got another example here, and this is actually a week or so old. It is written by a physician by the name of Russell Saunders. Of all the things to be nostalgic for, infectious diseases probably don't make it onto many lists. However, if you happen to pine for the good old days when measles was an active public health threat, I have good news for you. The anti-vaccine crowd is bringing it back. There is currently an outbreak of measles in New York City. Considered eliminated in the United States in 2000, last year saw a record number of outbreaks around the country. It's only 3 months into 2014, and not only is the nation's largest city seeing cases in several boroughs, but other major metropolitan areas are warning of new cases as well. This is not some inconvenience to be laughed off. Measles is a highly contagious illness caused by a virus. It usually presents with a combination of rash, fevers, cough, and runny nose, as well as characteristic spots in the mouth. Most patients recover after an unpleasant but relatively uneventful period of sickness. Unfortunately, about one patient in every 1,000 develops inflammation of the brain, and 1 to 3 cases per 1,000 in the United States result in death. Reports from New York note that several people have been hospitalized, and infected patients include infants too young to be vaccinated themselves. Because the American public hasn't needed to worry much about this once-contained threat in quite some time, most people probably don't know that measles can kill or leave children permanently disabled. We vaccinate people for a reason. It is because I never want patients in my office to contract vaccine-preventable illnesses like at least 2 unlucky people in New York City in the New York City outbreak who got the disease from visiting their own doctors, that patients whose parents refuse to vaccinate them are not welcome in my practice. I cannot entirely eliminate the potential for disease exposure between children who come to see me, but I can do my best to mitigate it. I never want to know that a child was sickened or killed because I let the recklessness of a vaccine-refusing parent jeopardize their health. But now, shoppers in Boston area supermarkets get to worry that they may have been exposed when they shopped for groceries. Commuters in the Bay Area now have to contend with the possibility that they or their children may contract the illness because they happen to get on the wrong train. Over 12 people around Los Angeles have been diagnosed with measles already this year, nearly half of them intentionally unvaccinated. This is sheer lunacy. Just over 12 years ago, this illness was considered eliminated in our country, and this year people are being hospitalized for it, all due to the hysteria about a safe, effective vaccine, all based on nothing. See, that's where I take a little bit of issue with Russell Saunders. It is not based on nothing. It is based on the affirmative belief that we live in a world where magic is stronger than the science of science. It is because we live in a world where people reject science as being some sort of spawn of Satan. Because we live in a country where a television station in Oklahoma blinks out the mention of evolution in a Fox Network rejuvenation of Carl Sagan's Cosmos. This is the titanic intellect of the American right wing and the American evangelical community. Remember, there was a significant outbreak of measles in, Texas, led by the daughter of Kenneth Copeland, who advised her congregation not to get vaccinated, because Jesus. Who knows? That measles vaccine may be the real number of the beast. Maybe there's six. Maybe there's six vaccinations with six different prototypes. And so measles ran wild there for a little while. Can I back up and point out that measles was one of the diseases that helped to nearly eradicate human existence among native populations in this hemisphere when the unwashed, dirty, filthy Spaniards and other Western Europeans began landing on these shores? Measles, chicken pox, the common cold, polio, smallpox. It took a population in central Mexico of some 20 million of human beings down to 4 or 5 or 6. And now, thanks to religious people and people who think they live in a world that is ruled by goddamn magic instead of orderly natural laws, you can get measles in New York or L.A. or San Francisco or Boston or wherever you are. Because that's the other point. Wherever you are, if you are in the United States, you may rest assured that there is some cabal, some coven, some church that is telling its adherents that magic is real and science is not. The article by Russell Saunders continues, "There is no legitimate scientific controversy about whether or not vaccines are safe. The original study that started us down this insane path by linking the MMR vaccine to autism has been retracted outright. The evidence against administering the MMR vaccine to healthy individuals is utterly without merit. But people continue to make the utterly baffling choice to refuse it anyway. Dispiriting new information seems to indicate that they are immune to persuasion when confronted with facts inconvenient to their worldview. Indeed, writers at prominent online media outlets chide us for demeaning vaccine deniers, saying to do so defies explanation." What are those prominent online media outlets? Well, how about Lawrence Solomon at HuffPost Canada? "Why the press shouldn't dismiss vaccine skeptics." The explanation is simple and is as accessible as the nightly news. Vaccine deniers are responsible to the resurgence of once eliminated illnesses. Their movement is responsible for sickening people. They are to blame for the word outbreak appearing in headlines from coast to coast. The anti-vaccine crowd may think they're only making a decision for their own family. In fact, they're threatening to make the rest of us sick. Refusing to vaccinate your children means you are contributing to a worsening public health crisis. And by the way, a public health crisis that is made all the more awful by virtue of the fact that we still have a profit-driven healthcare system in which people still remain uninsured, in which there is still a broad crack for people to fall into between the cutoff threshold for expanded Medicaid, if one happens to live in a Medicaid expansion state, and an even broader crack for those who cannot qualify for Medicaid in the Plessy states, and the price for subsidized for-profit health care under the Affordable Care Act. It's a big crack. The crack is big enough that, frankly, what's there is more crack than floor. This country, which I argue is in the midst of collapse, can ill afford an epidemic of anything. Russell Saunders concludes writing, "I hope the anti-vaccine movement somehow loses steam. Perhaps America will take note of the return of long-gone illnesses and will stop treating vaccine denialism as a viewpoint worth considering. Perhaps vaccine-refusing parents will consider whether it's worth the anxiety of knowing that a person who coughed in their grocery store 2 hours earlier could infect their kids as they do the week's shopping together and will reconsider their choices. There is no good reason for there to be a measles outbreak in New York or Boston or L.A., but there they are. If you missed measles and are glad it's back, thank a vaccine denier." Of course, if you asked former liquor supply officer Marion Robertson, he would tell you it's probably because you had not forgiven someone. Because science is meaningless. And the world would be so much better if only we could go back to the Dark Ages. Irish Dave noting, clearly, patois is wrong. Cancer is a side effect of beaming up and such as that. Sure. Jeremy in Vermont noting, blame the outbreak on the likes of Jenny, my son was cured of autism that he never really had McCarthy. Yeah, she's part of the problem. Jeremy also noting, that guy being interviewed on CNN by Don Lemon sounds a lot like conspiracy writer Brad Meltzer of H2 and book fame. That was exactly who that was, Jeremy. Anything but it crashed. Aliens, terrorists, Obama bin Laden from Kenya. Sure, all kinds of possibilities there. But this, maybe you think this is trivia. I don't know. But I can promise you that this is going to have long-term consequences. I am quite comfortable saying that. So Jets here in the 21st century, We are 45 years past the moon landing, which, as Robert in Australia noted last night, there are still a bunch of people don't believe, happened. It was all done on a soundstage. Because you know they can do that in movies. Why couldn't NASA do that? Right? We're 45 years past the moon landing, and we've got a big enough portion of the population to be dangerous, who would rather see, I don't know, what are these people? Are they Malthusians? Are they hoping for that pandemic that'll trim the population a little bit here and there? We have an overpopulated world. There's no getting around that. we have a world that can feed part of itself only because a big part of the world isn't getting fed at all. But the whether it be global climate change, whether it be the realities of what coal toxins do to the communities where it is extracted, whether it be the broadening disease that afflicts areas that are being fracked, whether it be the impact of spills along the Keystone XL pipeline to the Ogallala aquifer, or the impact on an aquifer of burning underground vast reserves of coal to turn it into natural gas. All of these things are associated with people who reject reality and prefer a world where magic rules. Because, you know, if we all just get on our knees and pray loudly and hard enough, then some deity, and it doesn't have to be Jeebus, and it doesn't have to be the great big juvenile bearded juvenile delinquent in the sky. Maybe it's Vishnu or Krishna or the Buddha or Huitzilopochtli or the dear one Flayed, or, you know, then they will intercede and cause the rules of nature no longer to apply. Great googly moogly. And it is largely centered in the United States. Among other things, France, which did a couple of things recently. One, they had a sort of too little too late experiment yesterday trying to reduce the number of cars on Parisian streets and highways, because Paris is getting so polluted that you can no longer see the top of the Eiffel Tower. And this past weekend, France, the French government, voted to prohibit the MON 810 GMO corn seed from, of course, Monsanto. The French government, which maintains that GM crops present environmental risks, has been trying to institute a new ban on genetically modified maize after its highest court has twice previously struck down similar measures. The decision is timed to avert any sowing of genetically modified maize by farmers before a draft law is debated on April 10th aimed at banning planting of GMOs. The sale, use, and cultivation of varieties of maize seed from the line of genetically modified maize MON 810 is banned in the country until the adoption, on the one hand, of a final decision, and secondly, of EU community action, said a decree which was published this past Saturday. Annual sowing of maize in France gets underway in the second half of March. Sane. Rational. So, you know, there's the French trying to do something, you know, sane. Because these genetically modified nightmares are the front end of potential famine. We talked a little bit about famine last night, didn't we? And it turns out that a report in Wired notes that the genetically modified BT corn, it's called BT corn because of Bacillus thuringiensis is a gene that causes rootworms to die when they bite the plant. BT corn because it has been so effective at killing Bacillus thuringii, effective at killing rootworms, has caused the rootworms to, and here's another one of those evolution, what evolution, moments. Turns out those rootworms have evolved, mutated, and changed, so that now these voracious worms are able to eat BT corn to no ill effect. BT corn, by the way, makes up of maize, 3/4 of the total maize grown in the United States. What was one of the causes of the great hunger of Ireland? The fact that the potatoes being planted were of one variety, and the fact that they were planted from other potatoes, which meant that basically the entire Irish, and for that matter European, corn potato crop were nothing but clones. It was truly a monoculture. Guess what BT corn is? Hello! Monoculture. I love, however, the fact that it is noted that, BT corn is not to blame. I mean, just because they took some corn and they spliced in a gene from the spleen of a Galapagos lava lizard doesn't mean the corn is at fault. No. Scientists, unnamed, say that mismanagement by farmers, corporations, and lawmakers that has led to the squandering of whatever benefits have been gained by the use of the genetically modified crop is what's to blame. It's kind of like saying that an AR-15 that was used to mow down a school full of seven-year-olds is not to blame for the seven-year-olds having been mown down and chopped in half. It was the mismanagement of the AR-15 by the gun industry and the goobers. I've got a goober story for you in a minute, too, because after all, by God, it is Titanic Tuesday. So, there's a study out there. People still trying to do science when you could say, hey, why is the BT corn being eaten by the rootworms that the BT corn was supposed to kill because it's got a gene spliced into it from the spleen of an Ecuadorian Galapagos lava lizard? I mean, that's the real answer, demons. Because we live in a world where natural law does not damned well apply. No. Aaron Gassman at Iowa State University was the lead author of a study called Field Evolved Resistance. See that word, evolved? Demons! Field Evolved Resistance by Western Corn Rootworm to Multiple Bacillus Thuringiensis Toxins in Transgenic Maize. Transgenic? What if they want to use the bathroom? The March 17th PNAS Journal published the report, and according to Wired, Aaron Gassman said, unless management practices changed, it's only going to get worse. There needs to be a fundamental change in how the technology is used. Kind of like there needed to be a fundamental change in how the technology of potato growing was used in Ireland. You remember when Jethro Tull came along and said, no, no, quit planting in those lazy beds. Use all the soil. Plant your seed potatoes down there where it's nice and wet, and the famine spores can multiply like Jethro. Not Tull, Bodine. We have been growing BT corn in this country since 1996. It's taken from 1996 to 2013 or so for the rootworms to mutate and evolve to where the gene from the Galapagos Ecuadorian lava lizard spleen no longer kills them. Actually, it's Bacillus thuringiensis. But this is stupid farming. And this is where science does get itself in trouble. Science in the service of science is nothing if not noble. Science in the service of capitalism is a series of disasters waiting to happen. Do you remember the polio vaccine, Jonas Salk? He and another scientist discovered the polio vaccine. And do you know what they did? They gave it away. They didn't say, gee, I'm going to sell this to the highest bidder because money. They gave it away so that mothers and fathers would not watch in impotent horror as their children had their entire futures stolen from them. They gave it away. And they did not die in penury and misery. A grateful world made heroes of them. Yeah. But here we are. Bad management practice? In order to keep the rootworms from developing a resistance to the BT corn toxin, farmers were told to keep refuges of non-BT corn so that rootworms could grow there unaffected. Those worms were meant to be mated with worms in BT fields in order to keep the worms from developing an immunity to the GMO corn. Scientists proposed to the EPA that farms should consist of at least half non-BT corn, but these regulations were opposed by the seed companies, who said, because money! And consequently, the EPA listened to the money instead of listening to the scientists and set what are called voluntary guidelines of 5 to 10% of land left for non-BT corn instead of half. And consequently, because the guidelines were voluntary, the farmers said, screw that! I'm going to grow all BT corn! And now, as of 2009, rootworms have returned to the cornfields in northeastern Iowa, and they had become resistant to the spleen gene of the Ecuadorian lava lizard that had been spliced, genetically modified, engineered into the corn seed. Don't blame the scientists. 2 years ago, they wrote to the EPA. They said, when insecticides overlay transgenic technology, the economic and environmental advantages of rootworm-protected corn quickly disappear. But hey, Pat Robertson could probably tell you, and millions upon millions upon millions of Americans would agree, that it's because someone isn't praying enough. Kumbaya. Inspiring, isn't it? No, it's terrifying. It's the kind of stuff that'll keep you up nights if you let it. I mean, that's why you turn on your particular poison, whether it's, maybe a basketball game or Honey Boo Boo Cha. Marty asking, I wonder what Victoria Jackson, Sarah Palin, and Michelle Bachmann would say about Dr. Salk. It was a miracle, and it was because we were under the protective grace of Christ Jesus. But now, because the gays are getting all married up and the secular humanists are eating our Bibles, the protective curtain's been pulled away and the rootworms is eating on the corn again. You think I'm kidding? I'm not. Got a pitch in my email today from Worthy Publishing, Dateline, Nashville, Tennessee. Courtesy of Mike Rudin of Shirley and Bannister Public Affairs, who will apparently sell anything for, well, because money. Hawking a new book by Pastor John Starve Hagee. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Like I said, this stuff won't save until tomorrow. Because this way lieth madness. On April 15th, 2014, a rare astrological event will occur. No, really, it's an astrological event. Astronomy doesn't even count anymore. It's not an astrological event, it's an astronomical event. Well, you tell me. The first blood moon in a series of four consecutive total lunar eclipses, known in the scientific community, demons, as a tetrad. April 15th, a blood moon, an astrological event. Of course, there's no blood involved. None. Because there's no blood on the moon. Because, see, if any of the guys who walked on the moon had, like, cut their little fingers on a moon rock, their suits would have depressurized and they would have gone pop and never come home. And to the best of my knowledge, Neil Armstrong did come home. No, damn it, he never left! The last three, according to Mike Rudin of Shirley and Bannister Public Affairs, who somehow or another goes home every night and, Mike Rudin writes, the last three lunar tetrads coincided with major world events that have shaped the world ever since. That's why Pastor John Hagee, because money, in his New York Times number 9, USA Today number 149, and Publishers Weekly number 3 best-selling book, Four Blood Moons, Something is About to Change. Well, talk about your specificity in prophecy. Four Blood Moons, Something is About to Change. You're damned right, Pastor John. I have actual plans of changing my underwear right after I take a shower. Four blood moons. Bob's changing his underpants. Four blood moons. An adolescent basketball player will change his socks. Oh, my God. Something is about to change. And it kind of reminded me of this. I actually think in my youth my brain was rewired by the lads over at Monty Python. It can be dangerous to expose a seventh grader to Monty Python, I think.
June 4th, 1973, was much like any other summer's day in Peterborough, and Ralph Mellish, a file clerk at an insurance company, was on his way to work as usual, when nothing happened. Scarcely able to believe his eyes, Ralph Mellish looked down, but one glance confirmed his suspicions. Behind a bush on the side of the road, there was no severed arm. No dismembered trunk of a man in his late 50s. No head in a bag. Nothing. Not a sausage. For Ralph Metsch, this was not to be the start of any trail of events which would not, in no time at all, involve him in neither a tangled knot of suspicion nor any web of lies which would, had he been not uninvolved, surely have led him to no other place than the Central Criminal Court of the Old Bailey. But it was not to be. Ralph Mellish reached his office in Dalzell Street, Peterborough, at 9.05 a.m., exactly the same time as he usually got in.
Morning, Mr. Mellish.
Morning, Enid.
Enid, a sharp-eyed, clever young girl who had been with the firm for only 4 weeks, couldn't help noticing the complete absence of tiny but telltale bloodstains on Mr. Mellish's clothing. Nor did she notice anything strange in Mr. Mellish's behavior that whole morning, nor the next morning, nor at any time before or since the entire period she worked with that firm.
Have the new paper clips arrived, Enid?
Yes, they're over there, Mr. Mellish.
Oh.
But for the lack of any untoward circumstances for this young secretary to notice, and the total non-involvement of Mr. Mellish in anything illegal, the full weight of the law would have ensured that Ralph Aldous Mellish would have ended up, like all who challenge the fundamental laws of our society, in an iron coffin with spikes on the inside.
Turn that thing off!
Liberal rubbish!
Yeah. John Hagee, Four Blood Moons, something is about to change. But it gets better. And notice, okay, see, the thing is, if this was referred to as a rare astronomical event, then, well, it would be a rare astronomical event. Cool. Go out. Watch the eclipse, okay? But it has to be an astrological event because it's going to cause something to happen. Pastor Hagee, with the pull quote for this pitch for this goofy-ass book, says, "It's rare that scripture, science, and history align with each other, yet the last three series of Four Blood Moons have done exactly that. Are these the signs that God refers to in his word? Starve!" Pass me a chicken leg. Maybe I should have issued the duct tape and tennis ball warning. Oh, God. The last three Four Blood Moons coincided with major changes for the Jewish people. The Four Blood Moons of 1492 heralded the Spanish Inquisition, in which the Jewish people were expelled from Spain. 1948 ushered in the birth of the State of Israel. 1967 resulted in the reunification of Jerusalem with Israel.
Worthy Publishing Group is a privately held independent voice in Christian and inspirational publishing based in Nashville, Tennessee, comprised of three divisions. Worthy Books publishes a boutique list of trade titles across a broad spectrum of genres, including current events, biography, fiction, devotional, spiritual, and personal growth, and specialized Bibles. Really? Specialized Bibles? Anybody want to start a thread this evening of specialized Bibles from Worthy Books? Ellie Claire is a line of gift and paper expressions, and Worthy Inspired is a quality impulse book imprint. Is this an impulse book? It's, I don't know, I tend to think it's warped. See? A
obligatory Star Trek reference for the evening. Four blood moons, something is about to change. You can't slip just a hell of a lot past Irish Dave. He knows, something about to change. Jesus! Microsoft will cease supporting XP. And have you never noticed in front of a Catholic church they've got that XP thing? Starve! Pass me the macaroni casserole, would you? Yeah. Interesting. I mean, 1492. Okay, the Inquisition. And as part of the Inquisition... Yes, Jewish people were driven out of Spain along with Moors. But, you know, the Moors are nobody special after all. 1492. Why does that stick in my head? Oh, wait a minute. Weren't we talking about measles and polio and smallpox and the common cold and the flu and how it wiped out... something like, you know, 11 million, who knows, human beings over here in the Western Hemisphere? I mean, if you were looking for signs and portents. Let's see, 1948. Formation of the United Nations, one world government. 1967. Summer of love, naked people on Haight-Ashbury tripping their brains out. Blood moons, four of them. Something is about to change. Yeah. Good Lord. And, you know, people are purchasing this book. You know, it renders you speechless after a while. By the way, just let me re-mention for folks who may not have heard. The telephone system here was fried by our fine coal-fired and publicly welfare-supported utility, Appalachian Power. We do not know if it can be repaired yet. I'm working on that. So if you're trying to call into the program at the usual telephone number, you will not have any success. I will not be able to answer the phone because the telephone processor is dead. Don't blame me. Thank Appalachian coal-fired power. Apparently, we've gotten under Robert and Australia's skin. Blood moons? Bob, blood moon is a term invented by Hagee. Astronomers do not use it. And the Bible says the moon will turn to blood, not turn red. The moon's going to have to turn into blood. It's going to just be one big clot hanging in the sky. And the tetrad has happened 8 times in the last 2,000 years, like clockwork. That's orbital mechanics for you. this blood moon nonsense is all over YouTube, and guess who's making a packet from it? Well, Robert, you say packet, we say bundle. Yeah, a fortune. Googly amounts of money. Yeah. Blood moon, something's going to change because money. So let's take a break. By the way, a reminder, even though you can't get through on the telephone system, you can get through on Skype if you want to join the conversation. Wait. This just in from Asa. Bob, if you want to look at the vaccine issue from a more realistic point of view, the return of measles could have something to do with the Supreme Court striking down DOMA. The veil of protection has been lifted from America. Oh, my God, I never realized that. Irish Dave, you're so right. Jesus, Bob, phones were effed during a full moon. Just coincidence or something more sinister? All mysterious. Something's going to change. Yeah. Let's Blood Moon, Red Sox win. Thank you, Devin. Let's take a break. By the way, it being Titanic Tuesday and all, Tuesdays and Thursdays are when we get the Green News Report, which I look forward to every week. Thank you, Brad and Desi. It'll be on the way. We'll take a little break and come back. This is conversation radio, such as we can still muster and manifest it. This is the Horn, trying to raise $150 this evening, or more, if possible. I mean, if this is a repair issue, it's going to take a lot. We're going to have to raise the repair money now, too, on top of the regular bills. A reminder, the regular phones don't work. If you're trying to dial 304-658-3333, you will have no success whatsoever. So anyway, a break. Brad and Desi on the way. This is Conversation Radio. This is the Horn. Still looking for the evening's first contribution.
And my time was running wild, a million dead-end streets, and every time I thought I got it made, it seemed the taste was not so sweet. So I turned myself to face me, but I've never caught a glimpse of how the others must see the faker. I'm much too fast to take that test.
Change it.
Turn and face the strain.
Change it.
Don't want to be a richer man.
But never leave the stream of warm and permanent sand. So the days float through my eyes, but still the days seem the same. And these children that you spit on as they try to change their worlds are immune to your
quite aware of what they're going through.
Changes.
Turn and face the strain. Changes. Don't tell them to grow up out of it. To her next to me, time may change me. You can't twist time. Strange fascination fascinating me. Our changes are taking the face I'm going through.
Changes.
Turn
the face of strange.
It's Tuesday, March 18, 2014.
Threats to systems supporting the electricity grid are evolving and growing.
Officials warn the entire nationwide grid could be knocked out. More new evidence that North Carolina collaborated with Duke Energy to derail lawsuits. BP is back, baby. Plus, surprise, Paris discovers stopping traffic really does stop pollution.
All of those surprise discoveries and more straight ahead. From BradBlog.com, I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
Stand by for 6 minutes of independent green news, politics, analysis, and snarky comment.
The Bible thumpers can keep denying global warming all they want, but I tell you, if Jesus came back to California, he would be pissed because there was no water to walk on.
Oh, ain't it the truth? This is your Green News Report. Okay, Desi Doyen, I hate to keep harping on this since I know much of the country, it's still very cold. But we were up again in the 90s out here in California, and I'm not saying that to rub it in. I'm saying that because it is now officially the hottest winter on record in California. It is the driest we have ever been on record. When should I start becoming concerned about this?
Well, I think people are already becoming concerned because it's going to raise food prices since the Central Valley of California puts out something like half the nation's fruits and vegetables.
Yeah, but will anybody understand that that's why their food prices are going up and that all of this is tied to global warming?
Probably not.
Not if they watch the other news services. So what do you have today in our Green News Report?
Well, first, an update on that massive coal ash spill from a Duke Energy plant in North Carolina that blanketed 70 miles of the Dan River back in February. A federal grand jury on Tuesday began considering whether criminal charges should be filed against coal giant Duke Energy and against North Carolina environmental regulators. That was triggered in part by new internal emails that show the state regulators apparently collaborated with Duke Energy to shield the company from environmental lawsuits.
So the state regulators, who are supposed to be regulating Duke Energy, are instead collaborating with them to help them avoid lawsuits.
Right. In fact, one internal email detailed, quote, exactly how Duke wants to be sued.
Duke writing to state regulators, explaining to them how they would like to be sued. Thank you.
Yeah.
Nice.
Yeah, and that's not all. The Associated Press reports Duke Energy last year lobbied for and received a special change in the law just for them, a special loophole from the Republican North Carolina legislature that protected it from ever having to clean up known coal ash groundwater pollution.
I don't think the word regulator means what you think it means, North Carolina.
And in the meantime, Duke Energy has agreed to pay the cleanup costs of that coal ash spill, but it's announced that ratepayers, their retail customers, will foot the bill to clean up the rest of Duke's 33 other coal ash ponds in North Carolina.
Man, what a scam.
but all's forgiven in the Gulf of Mexico, where BP is back, baby. The Environmental Protection Agency has just agreed to let British Petroleum return to deep water drilling in the Gulf, declaring BP, quote, a responsible contractor, eligible to seek federal leases in the Gulf.
Everything's fine if you're Duke Energy, if you're BP.
Yep, it's only been 4 years since BP's negligence and corporate culture led to the deaths of 11 rig workers and the biggest accidental offshore oil spill in world history. Remember that bizarre sniper attack that nearly knocked out an electrical substation in California's Bay Area back in April?
I do.
A disturbing new security analysis concludes that the entire United States is vulnerable to a coast-to-coast blackout that could last for months. That's if a targeted attack knocked out as few as 9 critical electric transmission substations across the country during a heat wave, according to an internal analysis by the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, or FERC, that was made public by the Wall Street Journal last week. The paper reported only the memo's broad outline, but FERC slammed the Wall Street Journal for essentially providing a roadmap to a huge U.S. security vulnerability.
Yeah, that's okay. Nobody reads the Wall Street Journal anymore.
Finally, Paris, France discovers that stopping traffic really does stop pollution.
What?
After days of dangerously high levels of smog pollution, officials in the City of Light banned half of all auto traffic from entering the city and instead offered completely free public transportation. After just one day, they say it worked. Smog levels dropped back to safe levels. So what did they do? Of course, they canceled the ban immediately.
Well, how did they decide who to ban for bringing in their vehicles?
They only let in cars with odd-numbered license plates.
Well, glad the smog is down, but that seems kind of a random ban to me.
But it worked, and of course they had to stop it then.
Sure, it would work if you banned all cars, too.
I don't see them doing that anytime soon.
Tyrant. For much more on that and the other tyrannical stories Desi is in favor of, check out our website at greennews.bradblog.com. Don't forget, download us anytime via Stitcher, TuneIn, or iTunes, where we hope you will leave us a good review. And find us and follow us on the Facebook and the Twitters at Green News Report. From bradblog.com, I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
And this has been your Green News Report.
find out for myself, don't you know, because, like I said, I've had a sheltered life down here on Music Row.
Well, maybe so.
Well, what do you think, Mark?
I don't know.
I really think that I can make the grade. There'll be some change. Now listen to this. I'm going to play some.
Comparable, immortal Chet Atkins alongside Mark Knopfler from an album they did together back in 1990 called Neck and Neck. I figured, you know, with the John Hagee and the Nashville Publishing House connection, we had some Nashville music. There'll be some changes made. Yeah. Let's see. Oh, by the way, thanks going out to Asa. Asa stepping up to try to help with the fundraising this evening. And we are now only $125 away from tonight's fundraising goal. Thank you very much, Asa. And I'm sure that Asa would love to have a little bit of camaraderie in the effort. So you know where the PayPal button is. And also on the website, you'll find the traditional mailing address. So that's what it takes to keep this all going. And well, it's been a brutal winter. Hopefully, I don't know what we got. Maybe one craptastic little blast of winter left in the forecast. We got a toasty 55 degrees outside right now. Maybe winter is done. One can hope. But hey, did you notice in the Green News Report? The entire American stupid grid, dumb grid, idiot grid, is in jeopardy. Gosh, an enlightened society might think about doing something like making every rooftop in this country a collector of solar energy and building a smart grid. But no, that's just silly communism, isn't it? It's unbiblical. Jeff is with us on the Skype line. Hey, Jeff.
How do you do, just to get some housekeeping cleared up, if somebody donates another $20 while I'm talking, I'll donate another 20.
Bless your heart, so, Jeff. Thank you very much.
So let's get that. Let's get some movement there. The other thing is, I was going to say that about the grid. I was, you know, the worried about the grid going down. But what I'd like your gang to do, you know, you've got a nice gang there. I'd like them to sit down and actually figure out why we aren't doing solar panels. Why it's taking this long.
Hey, Jeff, I think those are great questions. Can I ask you a question? I hear a thumping in the background.
I'm sorry. When you were listening to the music, I was sort of doing something with the music as well.
Okay. Oh, I understand. It's just, you know, I don't want anybody thinking that you've, you know, taken your shoe off and you're pounding on the podium.
No, I stopped doing that about 40 years ago. It would be nice to see, you know, you got to step back a bit and say, why? I mean, the smart move, is, if you know that we put solar panels on half the rooftops, especially down in Florida, or even in New York, it works great.
It'd work great here in Appalachia, Jeff.
Right, but so why? The bottom line here is, why isn't it happening?
Can I take a run at that?
I please wish you would, because I'm so tired of hearing that it's politics.
Well, I mean, if you know me, I'm a long view kind of guy. I remember after the Carter administration left the White House, one of the very first things the brand new Ronnie Reagan administration did was to pull the solar panels off the White House roof because that was simply intolerable.
Right. And
of course, who financed Reagan's campaign?
We just got to the crux of the matter. Who financed the campaign? Who was financing all the campaign? Who, in fact, is running the GMO things we talked about for profit, the mountaintop removal for a profit?
Please don't say the Illuminati.
No, I can't do it. No, as a matter of fact, I know people who are waiting for the beast to come to fix the problems. You know, the beast is going to come. I can't believe it. It's okay if that's what they believe in.
Well, you know, I mean, if it's not the beast, the beast would run from Cthulhu.
Well, the problem, I really would love to see, you know, you've got a reasonably smart gang there. You know, on the.
Oh, I think we've got just about the smartest little gathering of folks out there.
So the mission is going to be, if they accept the mission, is to step back and say, what is the problem with the systemic problem with both parties, the Republicans and the Democrats? What is the systemic problem? Why do these psychopaths have to make so much money other than the fact that they're good businessmen and don't care who they kill at all costs? And is there a possible way to put some kind of an insulator so every human being has a good quality of life and the psychopaths stop killing people and all of a sudden, we have clean air, clean water, clean calories. It's part of the game. And we have a place to live and education for all. Now, I have a feeling that if we allowed education to flourish, like Dr. Bill talks about, you would probably fix the problems with maybe population growth. I'm not saying you will. I'm just saying that...
That at least you've got a fighting chance under that rubric.
That scenario, right. And then we probably have more doctors, because now you can have someone who doesn't have the money to become a doctor to actually go to school, and they can go to school, and they got more doctors. Then you got more educators, because it doesn't cost you that much money or any money to go to school. And you're going to have more poets, and you're going to have more musicians. And
painters and actors and dancers.
Right.
And you know what? I think a culture that has more of those people, oh dear, is a richer, more viable culture.
I tell you, I have been to Cuba on the invite of the United States government many years ago. And that invite of the United States government was actually... when I went there, I was so impressed. Now, of course, I was told not to speak in the hotel room because they might lock me up. But I was so impressed with the people there. They had no money, but the dominoes, the art. Every kid spoke several languages. I went to go to the dentist there, and you just walked in off the street, and you were taken care of. It was remarkable. And the only reason why they have the problems they have there is because we have economic sanctions, only the U.S., by the way, against them. But I met all the Germans that were there and all the Canadians that were there, and they really had a great quality of life. I don't mean to mean that. I'm not saying communism is the best thing, but any ism that gives human beings education, food, and shelter can't be all bad.
No, in fact, I think it's generally good.
So we got to sit back. I would love to see maybe the front porch next Friday. I can't be there on a Friday, but I'd like to see the front porch, you know, have like the question, like, what is wrong with our, and it's worldwide, it's not just U.S., it's worldwide. What is wrong systemically with the system that allows this kind of behavior that is definitely going to, you know, it's going to collapse upon itself, but when it collapses, many, many, many human beings are going to die, including the grandchildren of the people who think they've got enough. At what point in time do we change that?
Well, it's a variation on that Shakespearean theme that some are born to greatness and others have greatness thrust upon them. Some are born to disaster and others have disasters thrust upon them. There are inflicted wounds and self-inflicted wounds.
But don't you think
what's going on in this country, let's make no mistake about it, Jeff, is a self-inflicted wound.
That I agree, but don't you think it's because of first of all, it's because of lack of education. And I think I had a friend of mine who I do programming with. He said, well, we have free education in this country. Now, he doesn't have any children. He's my age. So he just remembers public schools back when he was going to public school. He hasn't probably walked into a public school in 45 years. Now, so I suggested to him today that he walks into a public school and realize that the public schools are literally falling apart. It's not like it used to be 40 years ago. And then the people who have money put their kids into private school or parochial school so they get brainwashed earlier. That's another story. No, I'm just saying that if we could get, let's say, five guys on a panel and say, okay, let's step back and figure out what the problem is, and it's mainly economics, systemic problem with the economic system, and what possible way is there a chance that we may be able to figure out a way to stop it?
Well, I think what you're asking, you're asking a human behavior question, Jeff. And maybe it's not a human behavior question, because I think there are countries in this world that are trying to address the problem before it gets any worse.
I agree with that, but they're all part of the economic system.
But let's stay away from there for a little bit. Let's talk human behavior. The essence of junkie behavior, on the other hand, is to keep pursuing the fix and saying, I'll get clean someday, as long as the fix is available.
Okay.
Few and far between are those people who are addicted to something who try to get, intellectually try to get well before something awful happens. I mean, ask any of the friends of Bill W. They'll tell you, I've been told this by friends of Bill W. that you got to bottom out. A person with an alcohol problem has got to have some sort of triggering bottom out effect before you go and decide to get sober. On the other hand, and I think that's what we're talking about here. And just because West Virginia and Appalachia, because this is the place that I am, I can use this as a case in point. There's nothing here except talk about how we've got to preserve these coal mining jobs because there are herdage. Never for a moment understanding or comprehending that this is a finite resource. Regardless of the devotion and the religious zealous fervor that we direct toward blessed, sacred, holy Mother Coal, it's still going to run out. And it's running out right now.
Hold it.
So the question becomes, in a place like this, you know, you look to government and you go, hey, dumbasses, great, you love coal. We've got it. We understand that. But it's not always going to be here. What are we going to do when it isn't? Because, see, we've got little petri dish examples of what happens when it's not here anymore. In the form of places like McDowell County, West Virginia, which has an average life expectancy for a man that is equal to that of a person in Namibia. okay? A Guatemalan person has a Guatemalan man has a longer life expectancy than a man in McDowell County, West Virginia. I mean, let's understand that. At one point in time, McDowell County had a population exceeding 100,000 human beings, which is a huge population for a little county in Appalachia. It moved more coal out of its county than any other county in West Virginia. It's gone. It's over. And what is left are 22,000 people, half of whom who have never had their teeth cleaned in a dentist's office. What you have now is an old clinic in one part of McDowell County. I know this because there was an editorial in the Charleston paper today. What was once a health clinic has been transformed into a medium security prison.
I'm in a very poor area in Florida, and I can tell you this, it's absolutely poverty stricken. It's probably, they call it, it's picking up, but it's absolutely poverty stricken. They're building a new, it's a prison system that keeps it alive, by the way. They just put another prison in, and the school is right next to the prison. Then there's the county building next to the school. There is one Mexican restaurant that's absolutely a great restaurant. They're building a brand new Salvation Army. They have a Burger King. They have a brand new Family Dollar going in, and they have a Dollar General running now, and the gas stations politicians own the gas station, and they gouged the hell out of the people for food, because the supermarket that was here 30 years had closed down. Now, they also burn sugarcane fields here, and it's really hard to breathe, and that's a problem similar to that of the Appalachian. Not as bad, of course. The other thing that I found very interesting recently is I had dinner last night with a friend of mine who's a very wealthy guy, has a place in the Florida Keys, but he likes this place better because he likes the idea that it's no traffic and it's...
Oh, people forget that there are very sparsely populated parts of Florida. I was looking at, Levy County and Dixie County the other day, just by happenstance.
They have
tiny populations, 30,000 people.
This part of Florida is all thousands of acres, about 1,000 acre of ranch land. It's a very large cattle raising area, and of course, U.S. sugar has been shook the hell out they've been subsidized the oil companies, and they are the ones this is Glades County. But this other fellow I was telling you about, I had dinner with him. He owns 3,000 acres of land in New York State. He was complaining to me his taxes are $250,000 a year for his land and school taxes. Now, his biggest thing, this is guys older than I am. He's a nice guy. I've been in partners with him in businesses, and I really like the guy. He's a very bright guy. He can't see what he's looking for at his age. He can't wait till they start fracking New York State. Now, I can't imagine the thinking process. I mean, to own that much stuff and to want to get more. I mean, I don't think the guy, I mean, we can call it greed, but it's much, much worse than greed. It's a sickness. So, and I don't think you could get rid of that sickness within humanity. I think there are people who hoard refrigerators in their backyard because they're going to use them one day. There are people who hoard, tchotchkes in their house. I'm saying that there's got to be a way to insulate the humanity. And when you say this is a humanitarian problem, I agree with you. And I think, I think the problem here is we have to start valuing human beings as for their intellect and their labor. Something similar to what Karl Marx was suggesting, but he never did that properly because there was never a measurement put on to value the human mind and labor. And once you value that, then I think you can insulate that so somebody who wants to keep on buying things. And the other part is, I hate to say this, but we need people who are so ambitious that they want to keep on growing and creating things as long as they're not hurting people below them. So what I'm suggesting is that if we had the measurement for a human intellect and labor, your humanitarian portion, and we then say, as long as you don't poison the air, water, and soil, and everybody has education, and you have a quality of life that you can live, you know, a place that's comfortable to live, then you can let these, I'm going to change the word from psychopath to great businessmen, to keep on doing what they want to do, providing they don't hurt the rest of the world population. Does that make sense, or do I screw that up?
No, I understand. You and I have a long-standing sort of genial disagreement on whether or not we need to be able to quantify something or not. I believe, and again, every time I use that word, I issue the caveat that I understand that that word, believe, is the single most dangerous word in the English language. But I believe that you have a hard time selling somebody on larger philosophical problems when what is immediately in front of their faces is a starving child.
Well,
you and I also disagree in so far as you seem to have despaired. Tell me if I'm characterizing you wrongly. You seem to despair of there being any political solution, whereas I tend to think that the only solution is political, or a primary solution is political. Politics got us in this mess, and it's got to get us out.
Actually, there's it's not a despair. I stepped back. I actually was very political for a very, very long time. New York State, by the way, I want to give this at, is they're having a huge rally in the front of the Capitol because they want economic disparity for New York State. There's a group running that. I just got the email. But
disparity or prosperity?
I'm sorry, prosperity. They want equal prosperity for New York State, and this one group is going to be a huge thing in front of the New York State Capitol. And again, we have very similar problems all over the world, not just in the States. And I want to just go back to what you were saying. I do believe that the political system got us into this, but the political system got us into this because it's controlled by the economic system. And I don't believe we can keep on trying, and the political system is no more than a money-making game. I get a tremendous amount of emails to donate to the Democratic Party.
Oh, Lord, I probably get 20 of them a day.
Exactly. So the point
Bless their hearts, all of them, they only want $3.
Well, that's the point. It's a money-making game. And on the Republican side, again, I have friends of mine who badmouth Soros. I have other friends of mine who badmouth, the Koch brothers. I mean, these are the big, big money in the game.
And yet, the funny thing is, and I saw this just the other day, and it comes in awfully handy. I saw a side-by-side comparison between the Koch brothers and George Soros. And lo and behold, there's really not a comparison to be had. On the one hand, you've got old Pappy Koch, who was more than happy to take a whole bunch of rubles from Joseph Stalin in order to help advance their oil industry into the 20th century. But then Joe stiffed him. So when he got back, he became a rabid anti-communist, and he founded the John Birch Society, paid for the founding of the John Birch Society, which immediately ran out and declared that Dwight David Eisenhower, yes, really, Dwight David Eisenhower was a commie stooge. Not just a sympathizer, but actually working for the Communist Party. Eisenhower. President Eisenhower.
No, I'm old enough to know that.
Oh, I know. See, on the other hand, George Soros is basically made into some sort of liberal baby eater.
Well, yeah, my people tell, the people that I deal with say, that guy went ahead and he bankrupts countries and makes a fortune on him. And I said, well, I can't.
Yeah, but the thing is, if the Koch brothers did that, they'd say that was heroic, entrepreneurial, capitalistic, Jesus.
But I'm trying to get to a point here that both of these conversations we're having now, and I hate to use the words limited hangout, but they are limited hangouts. They get us arguing amongst ourselves about who's doing what, and we can't come to the basic problem, which, and I love, I hate to go back, to, I don't hate to go back, I want to go back to Dr. Bill's analogy where we're looking to elect leaders to put ladders up to fix the ceiling on certain walls. And I love that analogy because we hire a leader, they put the ladder up on the wall because the roof is falling down, but no one understands there's a dome over the whole damn building that's collapsing. And the dome is the economic system. It's not the individual. We're so busy looking at where the flames are that we have to put out. And I'm not saying you must put the flames out in your backyard, but you have to look to see where the flamethrower is. And I believe the flamethrower is in fact the worldwide economic system. And you can't go back just 200 or 300 years. You have to go back thousands and thousands of years before Christ, when the economic system first started, and it was never.
Then you've got to go back to ancient Sumer and Ur and Akkad.
I understand, but I can't. I'm just trying to keep it within some reason here. But I'm saying that once we put a value on a human being, and you couldn't have done that 1,000 or 2,000 or 4,000 or 8,000 years ago, but right now, every human being in the world uses the same amount of calories, more or less, to stay alive. Every human being in the world will produce X amount of BTUs or joules or whatever to stay alive. But and certain human beings will be worth a little more than others depending upon their education, their ambition, their personality, but no human being is worth a million times more than my granddaughters or your grandchildren. They may be worth a little more, but not that much more. And I'm just suggesting that every human being in the world, if they're willing to work a reasonable time, meaning between 3 and 20 hours of their labor and intellect, depending upon how ambitious they are for that short amount of time, will have their education, food, and shelter. And their total education as far as they can go. And their food, meaning clean air, clean water, clean calories, and shelter that's safe. Now, that gives them the free time to learn more or better the society around them. So the measurement that I'm suggesting is not to be in currency of any type, because the currency is contaminated. The basic minimum, and you brought this out to me. I didn't believe it when you told me, as Nixon said, that we need a living wage. Well, I don't believe it's a wage. I believe that there's every human being working.
A living standard.
A living standard.
Okay, well, you've drawn a question in from Irish Dave.
Good.
And Irish Dave wants to know, do you believe in an economic system based on exploitation can be made non-exploitive?
Yes, and I'll explain that why. If we actually said that every human being in the world, now this has to be I'm suggesting what's missing from all.
Man, the minute you say every human being in the world, you're going to lose a whole bunch of people because they're going to start hopping up and down and ripping at their clothing and speaking in tongues and drinking straight wine and screaming, one world government, God!
No, that's their problem. I'm suggesting that what's missing from the world, vocabulary. The world vocabulary is missing a measurement that has to value a human being, not what the human being's product would be, like, I know people.
No, you want a base valuation of human worth qua any human being on the planet. Everybody has an equal base measurement of worth.
Go ahead, you got it.
That generally we hope will deviate upward, but never deviate downward.
Right. Keep on going. You're doing good.
No, I understand it.
But we just don't think it's possible. Got to understand it.
I just don't think it's possible.
Well, I'm saying,
and like I've said before, the minute you assign some sort of numeric value, you're gonna, like I said, and you hope it never deviates downward. Well, what happens when the autocrat says, "You, Pavlov, Pavel, over there, you. You deviated downward twice this year. It's off to the ovens for you."
Whoa, no, because every human being, if you look at it like it was, I forgot where I saw this. There was an electric, let's suppose that we have an amplifier. And on the bottom, underneath the amplifier, there's a safety net, an insulating block. And all the people who are very ambitious and they want to build, you know, they want 30 houses and 20 places and 1,000 boats. They're on top of it, and they're amplifying. They're all doing, but the people who say, "Look, I want a really good quality of life, but I'm not that ambitious," they're underneath this insulated block. And they get within this insulated block for their 3 to 20 hours of labor. They would have, in fact, education, food, and shelter. Now, if this person, let's say in Indonesia, this high-powered guy goes to the Indonesian people and say, "I want you to work for me for next to nothing." The Indonesian knows what he's worth because the world accepts the measurement. And they say, "Sorry, my value, you must give me..."
Well, yeah, and okay, in that instance, what you're talking about is one world union and, you know, the same thing that the internet, that the IWW was talking about at the beginning of the 20th century, where basically the entire working class of the world engages in collective bargaining on its own behalf.
No, I can't say that, because all I'm suggesting is not collective bargaining. I'm just suggesting a very...
Jeff, if you have an essential baseline of human worth, that is a collective bargain.
Well, it's just to understand a measurement that every human being has a value, just like an inalienable right or a human right. But the value is education, food, and shelter for a short amount of their life putting into the society around them. And I think if we could understand that measurement, whatever the measurement would be, that no human being will have to work more than 20 hours a week, and they will be, and there's enough natural resources. You can't tell me there is not. There's plenty of natural resources. If you decide you want education, it's available to you. If you decide you want to eat good food, it's available to you. If you feel as though you want a comfortable, that's a safe place to live, it's available to you. We're not saying you have to do this. We're saying it's available to you so you can have that. Just like if I go to Cuba, I have shelter, education, and food. Not the best food, not the greatest, fanciest shelter, but it's available to me. And that's, if they can do it in Cuba, we can do this around the world. But the individual has to realize they are worth. And that's how we judge the GDP around the world.
And you've got a question coming in now from Jack in Shreveport. Yeah. Would a person's essential human worth metric fluctuate with supply and demand? I mean, as in with total population?
Well, no, because the education process, if you're educated... If you have education that you would have because you've worked for it between 3 and 20 hours a week, your education process would actually show that you would learn what the population can handle and how this would, you would control population by not edict, but by education. You would control food by education. Healthcare by education, more doctors, more more engineers by education. I mean, that is so. I'm not suggesting we pick up a gun and overthrow a government. I'm just saying we just have to agree on this language, in the human language, a base measurement for humanity. I don't care what the measurement is, by the way. It doesn't matter. But the base has to be, for anybody working in this world society, would be education, food, and shelter.
Can I ask you another esoteric question?
Please.
At what point in time, in a human being's existence, does the metric attach or vest?
If I believe that we have the ability right now, that if we can get some young guy or old woman who knows how to use the social network system with either a cartoon and say I am worth education, food, and shelter for what I do.
No. I don't think you get the gist of it.
I didn't hear you. Right.
I don't think you get the gist of my question.
Go ahead.
At what point in human development does this metric, whatever we're going to call it, whatever it is, at what point in human development does it vest, does it settle upon a person?
If we've got
some number that says every human being is worth X, at what point does the human being get to be considered X? Does that human being have X value at one day old?
At birth, certainly. You're just like a Social Security number.
Okay, so does that human being, because see, this is where the problems are going to arise.
Go ahead.
Does that person have that worth in the second trimester? How about the first trimester?
Whoa. You are talking to somebody who believes that that child, there's no such a thing. That's a fetus until it's separated from the mother. So I'm not going to go back to. I'm not going to buy into that.
Well, Jeff. I am not asking for your buy-in. Okay.
And by
saying that, I'm not being an ass either.
I'm telling you that we have
a problem right now, here in America.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
Where
right.
people want to consider little wads of tissue attached to the uterine wall to be fully vested human beings.
I get hit with this. And I won't even. I have people yell at me about partial. When I ran for office, they said, "You got to talk about partial birth. You got to not allow that." I said, "No, I can't. If I put my foot in that door, or I let them."
This is why I don't run for office, because if somebody says partial birth abortion to me, I got an answer for that. Only thing is, it'll be sufficient to keep me from ever getting elected.
But I will yard warden.
But here's the answer to that.
Go ahead.
There's no such thing. There's no such thing as partial birth abortion. It is entirely a figment of the weird, sick, twisted imagination of the fundamentalists, the evangelicals. Okay? Because there is not a situation in which, because it's like they masturbate over this stuff. They're such gross people, Jeff. Because they love to talk, well, you know, partial birth abortion, when the baby's head comes out of the mama and the doctor jams a pair of scissors in the face of its neck and turns its brains into scrambled eggs and throws them on a griddle and fries them up and have them with liver and onions.
That is between God and the mother. It has nothing to do with you or me. And until that umbilical cord is cut, that's part of that woman. That's my belief. But that's my personal belief. If someone else has another belief, I can't change it, and nor do I want to. And by the way, there's a friend of ours who just wrote a book. He's a PhD named Paul. Oh, gee, I didn't remember. He just wrote a book about the belief system. Paul Marco, Dr. Paul Marco, and he's did a great book about belief systems. I'm plugging his book, but I
Irish Dave wants to know when in this system that you envision, when does the work requirement kick in?
Okay, there's a group out there called the Venus Project. There happened to be Jacques Fresco is he's 98 years old as of 2 days ago. I believe that there's enough natural resources and there's enough machinery that anybody, you can't stop human beings from working. They really want to work. And I don't believe this thing that those people are lazy. I can't buy
that. Last night we were talking, just by way of example, about a little 12-year-old boy who was killed inside a coal mine on August the 4th, 1896, in West Virginia. The record still exists of his former existence. he was working for a living at 12 years old inside a coal mine when he was run over and crushed. He wasn't there because he had some innate desire to work.
No, but that was forced labor.
Well, it wasn't slavery. This is 1896, not 1856.
We have it now that people are working. They hate their jobs. The money is in the way. They have to make a living. They're already alive, but they have to work X amount of hours to make a living. Why not set up? First of all, the first thing we got to do, the first thing we all have to agree upon is human beings have a value, and the value is for between X amount of hours of labor, no more than 20 hours, they would be working for education, food, and shelter. Once we've accepted the measurement, now the systems, whatever the various systems will be throughout the world, that will start some movements happening. Then the only thing that will change, that has to be changed politically, because the political system then falls into line, what changes is how we do the gross domestic or gross national product. Once that measurement is accepted, and I can tell you for a fact, I was recently in the hospital, and I had some serious work done in an emergency room, and these interns came in, or I guess they were even orderlies, and it was an emergency situation. They broke their ass, and then this pompous ass doctor comes in, who knows more than these guys, I'm sure they, or the females, I'm sure that he knows a little more, but he's nowhere worth the kind of money he's getting. He is worth more because of education. But these guys who are busting their ass at 2 o'clock in the morning, and even the doctor who came in at 2 in the morning from the emergency situation, I mean, that's a huge...
I guess what I'm saying, Jeff, is that once one wanders down the path on this, it becomes apparent, at least to me, that there are some problems that become insoluble. For instance, Irish Dave asking, but what about those of us who do work but have no interest in a job?
That's fine. That's part of the measurement. Of course, you don't have to work a job. You don't have to do.
And what about the essential and the essential structure of workers and bosses? And what about middle management? Is this going to be something where the world is just constantly going to be rearranging itself so that people who want to be insurance paper shufflers, because from the time they were tiny, they said, you know, I want to spend my working life being an insurance paper shuffler.
Well, I want to work for McDonald's or Burger King. That's my goal, right? I'm sorry. No, all I'm suggesting is we just have to put a value on human beings. If the value is that every human being, no matter where they are on the planet, will have education, food, and shelter for a reasonable amount of time, and for their intellect and their labor, they will have those three items. Then they have the free time to either work more to get their gold-plated Cadillac.
I get that. But from the present circumstance, Do you see, Jeff, what an uphill climb you have? Because we live in a culture that cannot even come to consensus on the fact that a child should be afforded more than $1 a day to eat food.
I am aware of the culture we're in. And the reason for the culture we're in, it's a cannibalistic culture. And the reason we're there is because we don't realize it. How would you tell a fish that the fish is living in water? How would you tell someone who's living in this horrendous society that they're living in the society that can't see where they're living? Because of we're submersed in this culture, this economic culture. I'm suggesting that we have to have a measurement for it.
I understand you are, but I tell you what, we're getting a lot of queries. Of people asking the hard questions about
this. Did anybody put $20 in yet?
No. I'm sorry.
Come on, guys.
I'm sorry to report.
You gotta put $20 in so we can get this show on the road here.
Well, I'm getting a little bit, I'll be honest, and this is just the nuts and bolts part of the conversation. I get worried. I do. because we have had brutal power bills here, and you know, now with this thing going down, I don't know if it's going to cost $700 to fix, $900 to fix, or we're going to have a brand new one for the low Kmart price of $3,200.
You mean the electrical service?
No, I mean there's bills. I was just commenting on the fact that because it's been a hard winter, the coal-fired electric bill has gone through the damn roof. And that's not even with us, you know, trying to remain super toasty warm. But, no, I'm talking about the telephone processor system. You know, most of the people call into this program on the telephone, Jeff.
Right, that's why I'm on the...
That's why you're on Skype.
Right.
Well, that telephone system is deader than a stump right now. And we know it's probably not going to be less than $900, and we know that it's not going to be more than $3,200. But you know, there's a lot of real estate between here and there, and you put a $20 challenge on the table, and well, we can't seem to get anybody to respond to it.
That's well, I'm going to kick in $20 no matter what we get the challenge or not. But still, in all, there's a lot of people listening to your program, so they all. I mean, everyone should. I mean, $20 isn't a big deal, you know. I think it may be a big deal to people who are on the edge, yeah. But in most cases, the people who are online listening to this, and on their iPads listening to this, I mean, the iPad costs them $100, and you know, they got internet in their house, and if they're on the chat room, they got a computer, so everybody can kick in a little bit. But and I'm just suggesting this.
I do appreciate it, Jeff. I sincerely do. But I was going to ask you one of the questions. Lottie was asking in the chat room, what about people? I mean, this is just a for instance. So you've got one of those high achievers who doesn't just want to put in the 3 to 20 hours a week and eat and excrete and die.
Wait.
Okay, I mean, you've got that baseline, but you've got an achiever who has done more than that, who has done well for herself. But somewhere along the way, she has gotten hurt. And she can no longer earn at the level which she aspired to. What do we do about her?
There are certain people who can't work. I have a doctor in New York, and she has a kid who has MS. She'll never be able to
No, work. No. I'm talking about the person who was a high achiever. Okay, they went out. They started out with your baseline metric of worth, and they increased their worth through hard work and wealth acquisition, okay? But, say, 15 years in, they're doing nice, they're doing good, they've got the living that they've aspired to, they're not trying to become a captain of industry or anything,
I got it. Here's what the deal is. Right now, if I work my ass off and I put in a lot of money into the system, I can write off. If I'm losing money like I have been for the past 5 years, I can then start writing off and drawing down on what I put into the system. The way the system works is not what I'm suggesting. The system will work in whatever way the officials or our society deems it should work. All I'm suggesting is a basic measurement which is missing from the world vocabulary of the value of a human being in the economic system. And it cannot be figured in a currency. That's the easiest thing to say. I'm online worldwide with some people from the Philippines, some people from India, and they love this because they're working their tails off, and they say, I see what you're talking about, and they get it. But the people who have money don't get it. They say, if I work just 3 to 15 hours a week, I'll have my education, food, and shelter. And now if I want more, I can work harder. And if I get sick or get hurt, the system is still there, so I'll never fall below my education, food, and shelter. And by the way, if you've made more because you've worked harder, you will actually have that still. But no one will ever, ever, ever fall behind not having education, food, and shelter, no matter where you are in the world. Now, once you've
done
that...
So your primary concern is on the front end establishing that base safety net.
Exactly. No, it's the measurement, not the safety net. The safety net will come after the for instance, a friend of mine was in New York this morning when I spoke with him. He said, it's 8 degrees here, man. I said, and he doesn't understand this thinking process about a measurement. I said, Dennis, I said, why don't you come over here within the next hour? He said, I can't get there in an hour. I said, even if you took a plane, you couldn't get there in an hour. And if you walked, it would take you 6 months at 5 miles an hour. So your measurement shows you that you can't get from where you are now to here. But if we but a measurement is what shows you that. You just can't arbitrarily wish to be where it's warmer. You have to have a roadmap.
Yeah, because I've tried that, and it doesn't work worth it. It doesn't
work worth a damn.
Nope.
Right.
Nope.
And you can wish it could be warmer. You can wish it could be 80 degrees when you're freezing your tchotchkes off at 40 degrees inside your room by the microphone. Yeah, you're freezing your butt off. But you can only wish it could be 80, but you know the difference between 40 and 80. You understand that. I'm suggesting we just need a measurement that's never been in the vocabulary of humanity from the very beginning. And we now can put that measurement in place, and that measurement is a block of humanity's time.
Okay, you are generating some significant discussion here. I just had a note in from Mark. Subject line of the email is labor commodified. He says we already have this system. Jeff is describing. It's called capitalism. Should we have commodified cotton pickers' labor? Some pick faster than others. Individual bargained contracts. If you commodify labor, you surrender to the unknown, to Wall Street. Fail.
And by the way, I've heard that argument before. I've been doing this now for several years. I've heard that argument. If I could pick cotton faster, should I get paid more? That's the question. If I can figure out.
And the question's been asked for quite some time. I can tell you, without firing up the Wednesday prayer meeting music. The very thing is addressed inside the Gospels. There's this parable of the, you can figure maybe Yeshua, the brown-skinned Palestinian day laborer and itinerant semi-literate rabbi, thought about this stuff a little bit, and he comes up with this parable. And he says, a man goes out and hires a field worker in the morning and says, I'll pay you a set rate. And he hires another field worker at noon and pays him the same rate and hires another field worker at 3 o'clock in the afternoon and pays him the same amount of money. So that the guy who's working from 3 to sundown is working a lot less for the same money that the guy started working for at sunup.
Exactly.
And
here's the flaw in that.
And what's problematic in that setup is the conclusion that Yeshua reaches. What it says, and this is out of the book of Matthew, let me get it right. He says, for the kingdom of heaven is like unto a man that is an householder, which went out early in the morning to hire laborers into his vineyard. And when he had agreed with the laborers for a penny a day, he sent them into his vineyard. And he went out about the third hour and saw others standing idle in the marketplace, and said unto them, go ye also into the vineyard, and whatsoever is right I will give you. And they went their way. Again he went out about the sixth and ninth hour, and did likewise. And about the 11th hour he went out, and found others standing idle, and saith unto them, why stand ye here all the day idle? They say unto him, because no man hath hired us. He saith unto them, go ye also unto the vineyard, and whatsoever is right that shall ye receive. So when evening was come, the lord of the vineyard saith unto his steward, call the laborers, and give them their hire, beginning from the last unto the first. Yeah, last hired. Yeah, last.
Right.
Right. And when they came that were hired about the 11th hour, they received every man a penny. But when the first came, they supposed that they should have received more. And they likewise received every man a penny. And when they had received it, they murmured against the good man of the house, saying, these last have wrought but 1 hour, and thou hast made them equal unto us, which have borne the burden and heat of the day. But he answered one of them and said, friend, I do thee no wrong. Didst thou not agree with me for a penny? Take that thine is, and go thy way. I will give unto this last even as unto thee. Is it not lawful for me to do what I will with mine own? Is thine eye evil, because I am good? So the last shall be first, and the first last, for many be called, but few chosen. And this is, you know, this is Yeshua actually trying to explain to a bunch of morons, because that's mostly who he wound up talking to, to a bunch of morons about equality in the kingdom of heaven, but it has been used instead as some sort of sick, perverted economic argument.
Wait a second. The reason why this became a perverted argument, or because we don't quite get this with that parable, what I'm suggesting is you don't pay somebody a penny. If they do work at all for whatever hour, so they put in, it must be a low functioning hour because there's so much prosperity in the world, that they will have not a penny, but their education, food, and shelter. You can't pay them a salary or money because the money is corrupted to begin with. The value is in the education, food, and shelter. The value is in their labor and their mind. So if a guy figures out a way to do the same job a little faster, it doesn't matter. He's still going to put his 3 to 20 hours in. That's why we figured out there may be some disparity in the amount of labor you'd like to put in. But you only have to do a small amount in that week's work. Of course, there's enough goods and services in this world to make sure you have your quality of life. So, but the minute you put a penny on it, or a ruble, or a shilling, or a feather, once you put that pay number on there, you've gone back to the initial economic system. So you must go way back before that.
There's Yeshua long before capitalism was even invented.
Actually, capitalism was invented back then. It goes back well before. You've got to go back to where humanity is considered. There was no transfer of goods and services through another form of currency like a feather or gold or silver. You've got to go where humanity is respected, just like the old Indians respected humanity. They respected life. That happened many times in cultures before, but now the entire world, including your Aborigines in your friend's neck of the woods there, Australia, they're affected by the economic system. So you need to get back to where human beings have a value of education, food, and shelter for a minimal amount of labor and intellect. And then they can, if they choose to work like, I forget her name in the chat room suggesting, they're working hard as could be, and then all of a sudden they come down with cancer or something horrible where they can't work anymore. They're still always taken care of. Their children are always taken care of because every human being is going to work somewhat. There is no such a thing as unemployment. There is no such a thing as poverty. There is no such a thing, because once you've put this measurement in place, you've basically stopped the wars, no matter what the isms are, because there's no reason to have a war if you've got your basic quality of life, education, food, and shelter. My God, man, this is such a simple fix that it's almost repulsive to the mind. Because it's just so simple. What is missing?
Well, and see that, and we've discussed this before, Jeff. But the problem we run up against is, and I say this as a matter of respect, not criticism. It is simple to you, because as you can see from the questions you're receiving, and I've got another one sitting here that's going to take a little while to go through. This brings up a million questions. You can see it. It's like Athena springing fully formed from the head of Zeus. It's fully formed, and you can see its impact, its implementation, its long-term consequences. It's all there for you, but it's not there. It's not there for a lot of other people. And I got to share one piece of brilliant humor. Our buddy Irish Dave is a master punster. And of your buddy who was cold in New York this morning, he just wrote, "So should we tell Jeff's New York friend that many are cold but few are frozen?" Called, chosen, you get it?
See, that's the kind of humor we need to move this concept forward. That's the kind of, we need to get that kind of stuff going forward. By the way, another friend of mine who was being very skeptical about a year ago, and he said, by the way, and he's a poor guy. He says, I've got education for my kid and myself. I've got food on food stamps, and I've got a place to live. What the hell do I need the HERM for? How do I get my Lincoln Continental? I said, well, you'd have to work for it the same way you would in today's market. He said, that's a lot
and
of
you know, but you know what? There's a problem there. There's one problem there.
Go ahead.
Hard work is not a guarantor of financial or fiscal or material success.
I agree. You're working hard, and but you enjoy what you're doing, but you're still working hard. The phone got hung up, and I said, well, if that's the way you feel, I can't change the way you feel or the way you believe. That's cool, baby. And we hung up. About 3 hours later, the phone rings again. He said, wait a second. In the HERM world, or in this measurement world, I will be able to work as hard as I'm working now, but I only have to work for 20 hours. And I get my food, which, by the way, in the state he lives in, he has to put in 20 hours of social service to get food stamps. But you get your food for 20 hours, your living situation, and your education. He said, that gives me the rest of the week to work if I want more. And he saw it. He said, by God, that means I can work harder and get my things I want. I said, that's right. So he saw where this measurement goes into place. He said, whenever he speaks with me, he said, by the way, everything I see in the and this is a right winger, in the politics, it's all about the economics. If we talk about my education system, it's all about the economics. He says, you are so right. He can explain this concept better than I can. And he sounds better, by the way. He's got a great voice. But the guy has done a great, I mean, it was so nice. Whenever you get somebody who understands the concept and can explain it better, it's like, I call it a blessing or a mitzvah or whatever you want. It just happens to be, and I'm not a religious person.
No, I know what a mitzvah is. Jack in Shreveport just asked the question, no currency? Is Jeff saying that there would actually be no money? It seems he is. That way, huge sums, more than one could use, could not be accumulated. If he is, Jack suggests, I would think that would be his central argument, not that humans would have some particular value.
This measurement is...
And I have to tell you, because I've got to go here in a minute.
Okay.
I want to create some space, because I can only do one call at a time, because of the way things work out right now. But I wanted to tell you that Lottie responded to your challenge, and he sent in $20 to match yours. And then another anonymous contributor said, fine, I'll answer the call and match Jeff's 20. And then our buddy Laborman kicked in 100.
Oh, great.
So actually, all taken together, challenge was answered by challenge, which was answered by challenge, and then Laborman doubled down. So if we could get folks to match what Laborman just did, Gary, I don't know, we might be able to start socking away enough of the repair bills on the damn phone box.
Well, hopefully it's not going to be that bad.
Something in there is fried, so, and this is a pretty heavy unit, so I know it's probably going to wind up being shipped back to Massachusetts, at which point the really, really wildly intelligent engineers up there will look at it and go, damn, what, wrong accent, damn, what in the world kind of bullshit electrical system have they got down in West Virginia?
Well, you need to put some solar panels on that with some batteries, and you won't have that.
You know what? I mean, that's a central tenet of how we go forward on this. And all it takes is a boatload of work and determination by a whole bunch of people who are willing to push out a crowdsourcing campaign so that we can raise the money sufficient to do this.
And to answer Lottie's question, this measurement is pre-currency. The currency kicks in after. I just want to answer that. Okay, well, good luck, and thank you all for kicking in some money, and we'll see you again as soon as this creek rises.
All right, you take care, Jeff.
Thank you.
Bye now. Jeff is always an interesting conversation, and I enjoy them. Let's let's just keep it rolling. Jeremy has called in on Skype by from Vermont. Hey, Jeremy.
Hey, Bob.
Hey.
Hey, you were right when you were saying that the right wing's all up in arms over the new Cosmos coming back.
They're going nuts.
They're going nuts because they're basically tearing apart all of their creationism piece by piece and showing evidence to prove that how wrong they are.
Well, that's what they are who they are.
Right.
What did Denny Green say when he was head coach of the was it when he was head coach of the Vikings or head coach of the Cardinals? They were who we thought they were.
I've actually watched the first couple episodes. It's pretty good. It's pretty close to what Carl Sagan imagined in the first part when he did the universe way back when.
It has to be different because there have been advances in science, and more than that, there have been advances in the ability to produce really stunning visual television. So you would expect both of those things to be in there. Neil deGrasse Tyson is not Carl Sagan. Carl Sagan was not Neil deGrasse Tyson. So it's going to have a different style. It's got different writers. I would assume, understanding the danger of assuming, that Neil deGrasse Tyson has considerable editorial control of the words that come out of his mouth. And so, yeah, I have not been able to sit down and watch entire episodes. There's no television here.
But
I've seen enough clips to be to be impressed with what it is.
It's definitely interesting. I also saw today that Putin said that troops are authorized to use deadly force in Crimea now.
Oh Jesus! I saw a note earlier today that I guess a Ukrainian soldier has been killed.
Yeah. And he also put out a notice today saying that officially they're part of the Ukraine now, or Ukraine's part of Russia now as of 9 a.m. this morning or something like that, their time, I guess.
Say that.
Now, yeah. Over there, isn't there a similar problem with, hey, we don't care how you vote, but make the right choice?
Well, wasn't it Stalin who said, I don't care who votes, I care about who counts the votes?
Well, exactly the same idea. It's like even what the brown coats and the Nazis did at one point, where they said, "We don't care how you vote, but make sure you vote right." Basically,
right.
And then stood by the voting ballots with guns in their hands. So yeah, I mean, 60 Minutes did a piece a couple weeks ago, maybe even this week. It was a couple weeks ago, and they did a pretty good piece on it. I mean, there's still thousands of people standing by saying that they don't want anything to do with this and that they want to keep Ukraine free from Russia's grasp. And, I mean, they're still setting up barriers and they're within striking distance of the military. And, I mean, again, there's those snipers that get called in that are killing people randomly that nobody's taking claim of.
And no really – well, what's been said is that well, a lot has been said. Some have been said that the government did it. Others have blamed the Nazis. And then I've also been told by a good friend, my buddy on Twitter, Fruity Wisco, that the Nazis are a very small percentage of the resistance in Ukraine. And I understand, you know, the Nazis were a very small percentage of the body politic in Weimar Germany as well. But look how they worked out, you know. And there's nothing can replace persistence. If you've got Nazis in your opposition, before I can ever feel a whole lot of sympathy, the Nazis have to go. And I don't like to do generalizations, Jeremy, you know that. But I hate Nazis. I hate fascists. There has never been one damn thing. And I will run screaming out of the studio on account of the first person who says, yeah, but Mussolini made the trains run on time. There's never been one damn good thing that has been done by fascists that can be that can somehow stand any sort of balancing test. I mean, you can make the argument that Mussolini uncovered a whole bunch of ruins of ancient Rome and saved significant chunks of Roman heritage. Beautiful, beautiful. But along the way, that also meant that Italy was plunged into the hell night of fascism and dragged into the Second World War. And you see what I'm saying? If there are Nazis in the Ukrainian resistance, the rest of the Ukrainian resistance needs to go out, round up the Nazis, shoot them, and then go on about their business of resisting Russia. At which point I can be wholeheartedly advocates for their cause. But as long as they got right. Nazis, they ain't got me.
I also want to mention, last week I posted something on social media. I don't think I think I put it on the Horns website, but I'm not sure. But it's a picture of the Confederate flag, and then it's a meme, and then it's cut off, and then the second half is of three African-American teenagers. I don't know if you've seen this yet. It's disgusting in every sense of the way it is. At the top it says, if you don't like this, then you can't support this. It's basically, if you don't like the Confederate flag, then you can't support young black men who have their pants sagging, because it's the same thing.
Oh, Jesus.
Yeah, they're trying to take a hate symbol. I don't know why we can't get through this people's mind. I mean, I have friends who grew up where I did in little town Vermont, moved to the South, and they've adopted Confederate flags like it's the best thing going.
Well, that's just so they'll fit in and people will quit calling them Nazis for talking funny. Yankees.
But they're the ones that posted this picture originally where I took it and clapped it to the Horn site saying, this is the stuff I have to contend with. People who say they stand for all these good things, but then they put this symbol up and try to equate it to young black males, and if you hate this as much, well, I hate seeing young black males with their pants sagging. That's what it said.
Jesus.
And I find that as offensive as you find a Confederate flag. And it wasn't...
I wish that giant Confederate flag that's flying somewhere near Richmond by the highway right now would just go up in spontaneous combustion, just go up in flames. Or say the really big, hideous, stupid statue of General Nathan Bedford Forrest that sits hard by the northbound lane of I-65 south of Nashville, up in flames.
Well, you know that Jesus statue in Italy or wherever it is, that huge one that sits on the ocean, that's been hit several times. Why can't these flagpoles get hit or just something random like that? I mean...
Well, because they're probably all lightning rotted up.
It's probably true, but yeah, I'd like to see all these flags burn up too, but I try to tell people all the time that...
Well, what you're identifying, Jeremy, is the essential dynamic tension between First Amendment protections on political expression and the need to have a civil society that isn't constantly tearing itself apart. And our answer to that dynamic tension has been thus far, for the most part, in the modern era, and I'm not talking about older American history, to say, you know, let the haters win, because we have to protect the haters so everybody else will be protected. I personally think that's a bullshit argument.
I 100% agree. I don't think we have to protect the haters. I think they're an open target. They bring it on themselves. Just because their hate and their ignorance is so outspoken, and even in what they would claim normal.
Well, and I say that I think it's a BS argument, Jeremy, because established First Amendment law says that there are some prior restraints that are not only not unconstitutional, but quite legal and quite necessary to the maintenance of a functioning society. The problem is that we don't see manifestations of ancient race hate in what is now the United States as rising to the level of incitement to riot. And maybe, and frankly, if there was a riot within its legal sense of the word, over the display of the right wing treason banner that is the Confederate flag, still the rioters would be the ones who are blamed.
Yeah.
You know, see, I disagreed with that stupid Supreme Court decision that said that the First Amendment guaranteed Fred Phelps and his weird crew the right to go and torment grieving parents. It was just wrong, because that it was obvious that that was rising to a level of patent incitement. Unfortunately, the only way to make the Fred Phelpses of the world stop is to give them a righteous curb stomping.
Why exactly did Fred Phelps get excommunicated from his own church? That's what I'm trying to figure
apparently
out.
Apparently there was a bit of a coup in, what, the summer of 2013? I mean, it's not like he became suddenly some man who was filled with love. What was happening is there was a coup in which he was tossed out because, if I understand correctly, the previous decision-making process had been based in a consensus of the whole body, whereas now they have this conclave of demons whose decision is final. And it was the conclave that threw Fred out in the streets and put him in the hospice house.
And don't allow the rest of the family to go see him. Jesus.
Yep.
Not that I want to see that kind of a monster anyway. But
yeah,
still,
well,
I mean,
you know, the love and grace that passeth all understanding. Just remember, when Fred dies, he's going to heaven.
Right? And
believes in Jesus, believes he was born of a virgin, crucified, rose on the third day, all the magic stuff. Fred's on the way to heaven. Don't you think that's going to be real interesting when he meets up with Dr. King?
If you played that sound clip that says, "I don't know if you think of what you think you know what you're thinking of," that would fit him
that
perfect.
Word.
That right there, yeah, you don't understand this. That would fit him perfectly to a nutshell. The other thing was I wanted to say about that Brad Meltzer guy that was on that CNN clip lately.
Yeah.
Earlier tonight. I don't know if you've seen that guy, but he's a creepy bastard to start with.
Well, I was watching the video. He looked pretty creepy.
Yeah, he's wide-eyed. He looks like Michelle Bachman in male form every time. Only bald. He's got glasses, but they magnify his beady fucking eyeballs. And
I don't think beady fucking eyeballs has ever been said on the horn, Jeremy, so, you know, congratulations.
Toaster. That's all I got to say for that. But, you know, I've seen his show just for entertainment purposes. I don't believe a goddamn word he says. I mean, he'll go into things like, "Hey, there's a back entrance to the Mount Rushmore Memorial, and you can get in there, and there's a gold mine in there, and they hide Fort Knox's gold." Crazy, crazy, crazy stuff. Just like, the gold isn't still at Fort Knox. It's been gone for years. They just say it's there. But he's doing something a lot more powerful than pot to give in them eyeballs. That's all I'm saying.
Yeah, how about psychosis?
Yeah, he's pretty close to psychosis. And I mean, he on his show, he used to have, it was on History, I don't know if he's been on there in a couple of years now, but he had a panel of three people that go around doing his research for him. And they were fairly crazy. But, I mean, if they'd say something even remotely logical to try to explain something, he'd beat them down with the craziness and say, "Oh, no, it has to be a conspiracy, blah, 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 blah." So, unfortunately, I watched enough of that show for entertainment. As soon as I heard his creepy voice, I knew exactly who he was without you saying a word about him.
And yeah, I noticed that, because I'm not familiar with the guy, and frankly, I'm terrified to find out.
He's big in the conspiracy field for writing books. He claims he is, but it's probably to hype his own personality, that he's a well-read author. He's written many, many books on things.
I love the clip on it. "Well, if anybody gets a bunch of loopy emails, that would be me. But," and then you go into the but. You know, what this guy is trying to do is position himself to be the Art Bell for the 21st century.
He has no chance. There's a long list of crazy people in front of him. He's still kind of an ant in a molehill. I mean, I don't know, but I'll let you go, since other people might want to be trying to use Skype, but I just thought I'd bring those things to the horn tonight.
I appreciate it, Jeremy. You have yourself a good evening.
You too. Thank you.
Bye now.
Bye.
Jeremy calling from Vermont via the Skype line. Remember, if you still want to participate in the conversation but you've never used Skype, one, Skype is stunningly easy to use. B, once you've set it up and got your audio to where it doesn't sound like you're hollering from the bottom of a tomato can, as most folks obviously the audio is pretty good here, then it's just a matter of sending a contact request to me, Bob Kincaid Horn, BobKincaidHorn, until such time as we get the phone situation sorted out. Let's see. Devin's with us via Skype. Hey, Devin.
Hey, Bob. How's it going?
Pretty good. Yourself?
Oh, I'm still above the dirt.
Every day above the ground's a good one.
That's a shame about your equipment, though. Hopefully we can figure something out.
Well, we're working on solutions. Obviously, the first immediate solution is in play right now because, obviously, you're on it.
Right.
And we're looking for other solutions. I know, for instance, our buddy Psychoticus has been working on some stuff, and John Fox has been looking at some stuff that would allow us to bypass this humongous, incredibly expensive processor altogether. We just haven't gotten it. And we haven't gotten it to the point where, you know, there's a working solution yet.
Oh, okay. About the earlier topic of human worth.
Yes.
Do you recall Switzerland and the guaranteed minimum income?
That they've got that, or
they were going to be voting on it. There was a national referendum. Unconditional minimum monthly income of $2,800 for each Swiss adult.
And of course, that's brutal, godforsaken socialism.
Oh yeah. In a not terribly socialist country, though, you have to.
Well, remember, in Switzerland, everybody has to own a gun.
Yeah.
Yeah. And, the right wingers love to point that out.
Well, and the other thing is, they do have a national health care system, but it's private. It's not for profit, but it is private.
And it's the profit part of it that makes ours so toxic, I think. I mean, Germany has a hybrid system. As both John Fox and Robert in Australia have told us, you know, you can go out and buy private for-profit insurance in Australia if you want it, but the national system is there for you if you don't.
Yeah.
This is not an insurmountable problem.
The unconditional minimum monthly income is basically would replace all their other programs, you know, I assume whatever their, food stamps or unemployment or, you know, all that stuff. You replace it with this. And there's no questions asked, you know, if you're the poorer than the church mouse or if you're the Koch brothers, you get the same check.
Yeah.
And then, you know, whatever you make beyond that is, you know, another
story. And see, it's interesting because for those of us who look, for instance, at Social Security and say, you know, lift the damn cap, you know what that means, the earnings cap.
Yeah.
Well, the argument that's presented against that is, well, if you lift the cap, then you have to pay back money commensurate with how much is being paid in by all those blessed, sacred, holy, beloved of God billionaires. In other words, the theory being that if billionaires paid Social Security taxes on every penny of the billions they make, then you'd have to send the billionaire a $1 billion check every month once he or she turns 65.
Yeah. But what they don't realize is if they did something like this, especially at, you know, this kind of level, they would not have to worry so much about living in their walled citadels and, you know, have to put on their Kevlar when they go to the border.
But do you think that's a little bit of a turn-on for them? Makes them feel like they're, you know, secret squirrel, you know, Johnny Dangerously, whatever?
Well, some of them. Some of them, you know, it's just all they've ever known. You know, they build the walls so they don't have to know. You know, and if they've been behind the walls all their lives, and you know, they're not going to go looking.
Right. Well,
you know, if they do peek over the edge, the grass ain't greener on the other side. So.
No, they don't. I just can't see a time in the future when Charles and or David Koch, and I don't know, have either of those filthy bastards spawned? I'm not sure. I can't see the day when they look up and say, hey.
I'm sure they have.
Oh, damn. I can't see the day when they look up and say, you know, I'm awfully grateful for this bowl of highfalutin dollar ramen with the spice booster pack, flavor booster packet.
Yeah, well,
it would be fun to teach him to be grateful for that, but, you know.
There was a movie with Dan Aykroyd and Eddie Murphy. What was that movie called?
Trading Places, and it was the Duke brothers, played by Ralph Bellamy and can't remember the other one. Was it Ralph Bellamy? Yeah, it was Ralph Bellamy.
They remind me so much of.
Oh, well, I think they are. I think they are the Koch brothers. I think that's who they were modeled on, maybe.
Wow. But yeah, you know, they need an experience like that. I mean, you know, there are people out here who are, you know, fomenting, you know, somebody who makes $1 billion, just knock them in the head and be done with it. But that's not creative. The worst thing you can do to a rich person is make them a poor person.
Mm-hmm. And then,
yep.
And there's even a little story in that Bronze Age book of advice for living life, all about that. The book's called Job.
Job.
Don Ameche.
I've never heard of that one.
Ralph Bellamy and Don Ameche played the Duke brothers in Trading Places. You've never read the book of Job?
Oh, well, Job, yes.
Yeah, Job. Because remember, okay. It's a story about taking away everything from a really rich guy. But it turns out being a story about not Job's ability to weather a storm, but what a colossal dick God is.
Yeah. Well, they didn't focus on that one where I went to school. It was mainly memorize Psalms and, you know, read Revelations or something, so.
Create in me, oh God, a clean heart and a clean mind and a clean body. Yeah. Yeah.
Oh. Yeah. Well, that and the godforsaken books of Paul.
I remember when, and I went to public school, I remember trying to get away. We had daily Bible readings. Jesus. And it wasn't that long ago. And I remember trying to get away with reading, I think it was the 119th Psalm or the 19th Psalm. It's the longest Psalm in the book, and every verse is named after a Hebrew letter. And I took off reading it. When's this end? Oh, you can't interrupt the word of the Lord, principal. And it just goes on. It's a hoot. I mean, it'd probably take me five, you know, just to kill time, and everybody got to rotate through and do the Bible reading that wanted to. And I remember one guy that snuck in and read a verse from the Quran, you know, just to be devilish.
Oh man. Well, speaking of biblical plagues.
Yeah. Were we? Okay. Well, yeah, Job, I guess.
Well, it's a good segue, anyways.
Of course, it's got a nice beat and you can dance to it.
We have a new invasive species in the U.S.
Oh, are these those giant, freaking crazy-ass hornets?
Yes, the Asian giant hornet.
They've made it here, because I read stories about people getting stung to death in Asia, but who's the genius who brought some of those over? Thanks, Noah.
Well, they probably built nests in shipping containers and things like that.
Yeah, they're like as big as your hand.
Yeah, they are about 2 inches long, big around as your thumb, and they have a quarter-inch non-barbed stinger, so they can sting you multiple times. And their venom has 8 different compounds in it.
You're just trying to give me nightmares now, aren't you, Devin?
Well, no, I'm trying to do a public service.
Oh, okay, because, well... the nightmares come with the public service, apparently. I'll be afraid to sleep tonight.
Well, yeah. But the, well, it's not quite warm enough for them yet, so you wait a few minutes.
We're working on that, though. Brought to you by the Koch brothers.
But the venom, the really nasty thing in the venom is the substance that's in spider bites. It causes the the necrosis and the big holes.
Yeah.
But and there's like 400 of these suckers in a nest.
God, how big must the nest be?
Well, it's big like a. Well, really big hornet's nest. I mean, you know, it's...
Yeah, I mean, is it one of those kind? It's not like a wasp nest, you know, where the open cells?
No, it's enclosed.
But the holes are locked. So you're gonna be hard-pressed to take it down with that 30-foot stream of decon?
Well, from all accounts I've seen, you know, you could empty a few cans on one of these things, and, you know, it's not going anywhere. You're better off to use a 410, I would say.
Yeah, or call in a napalm strike.
Exactly. And they're highly aggressive, and if you, you know, get anywhere near the nest, they'll just attack you. And when one attacks you, of course, it tags you with pheromones and, you know, the rest.
And everybody else joins the party.
Yes. And these things, their primary diet would be honeybees. They find those very tasty, and they
bastards.
They attack their nests and take the larvae, because there's something in the larval saliva that's useful for their young. So they take those back to feed to the young.
Hey, Grandpa, what's for supper?
Yeah. And
well, that's we had a conventional hornet's nest down on the property line with our neighbors who fly the Confederate flag. And I think those hornet's nests are kind of elegant and beautiful. And as someone who has an appreciation of nature, I understand that some nature must be appreciated at a great distance. And so I didn't screw with the hornet's nest, and I told our children, don't screw with the hornet's nest unless you want to be stung badly. Leave them alone, and they'll leave you alone. Well, our neighbors with the Confederate flag, they take the Fort Sumter approach to hornet's nests. So lo and behold, there I am one day looking out, and, you know, there are the two kids out there whacking away at the hornet's nest with a stick. And I'm thinking, evolution in action? I mean, son, go down there just like Pierre Gustave Toutant Beauregard did, and let loose on that, pretend that hornet's nest is Fort Sumter.
And then they
had to turn tail and run, you know, just like treasonous Southern soldiers.
Yeah, I'm looking at a picture of one of these things. It's got a cicada that it just bit its head off. It's carrying a cicada.
Wow. Yeah, you can almost imagine the poetic justice of it doing the same thing to a praying mantis and say, "How do you feel about? How does it feel to you now, huh?" Head biting off.
Yeah, there was somebody in
I
Virginia
like praying mantises,
who got attacked. Well, they eat praying mantises too. They'll bite the head right off of them.
Which must come as a shock to Mrs. Praying Mantis, who is used to doing all the head biting off of things.
Exactly. But there was somebody down in Virginia who got attacked by one of these. He was just standing there doing nothing and heard something that sounded like an RC airplane on a nosedive and looked up just to, you know, get whacked by this hummingbird-sized bee that stung him on the ear and his whole head swelled up.
I bet those things are going to be hell on windshields, too. I remember a great Porsche ad from years back that just showed the field of vision inside a 911, you know, looking out the windshield over the boot, and all it said underneath was "kills bugs fast."
Yeah, I remember the last time we had.
Hey, Devin, I got to get out of here. I just the rest of the Horn family does my time checks for me. I got to get out of here, buddy.
All right,
you have yourself a good evening. Our buddy Devin, scaring the daylights out of me. Eek. Giant freaking hornets. Nah, we're not screwing up the ecosystem. Hell, it'll probably turn out that they've got a taste for tar sands oil or something. Thanks, everybody. Thanks especially to those who helped us take care of funding for this evening. Thanks to our anonymous contributor, thank you to Gary, thank you to Jeff, thanks to Asa, thanks to Lottie, thanks one and all. Thank you for all of you taking the time to share in the program. It means a great deal. Thank you to our all-volunteer staff, Lottie and Sparky and Texas Betsy in the chat room. Thanks to our news ninjas, Gene and Susan. Thank you to John Fox in Australia. Thank you to Ben Birch, WhiteRoseSociety.org. Thanks always go out to the hardest working, bravest people I know, the men and women at Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net, and AICACT.org. And always, 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 Gina, it's all for you.